Coming to you from the eye of quite the media storm. For want of a better phrase, it seems that the B-sky be's the limit. With media mogul Rupert Murdoch having to bow out gracefully from further media monopoly, which has made news of the world where the publication probably never did. Hi there, my name is Mick Caldwell, and it's all highly manic within the media landscape, so you've got to be tuned into the weekly community radio program, The Fourth Estate. Check out the fare for today.
Certain substances have their place, and a lot of musicians will say they're so hyped up, you know, after a big performance, that they need a glass of wine, you know, to wind down. Nigel Kennedy was busted in Germany for having marijuana, and he told the police that he could not do his job, which is an international solo violinist, without it. If these substances are used very judiciously and hopefully under medical supervision, they do have a place in the management of severe music performance anxiety.
And later on the show, we delve into the complex and often tortured psyche of a touring musician and why one university professor felt the need to bring it to our public attention. Well, the hype is still running rampant about the Pandora's box of this News of the World fiasco, particularly regarding the ethics of journalists and the accountability of their actions. These notions of hacking into people's phones and bribing police, which were paramount in the decision by Murdoch to close the publication, have serious legal repercussions that are beyond the bite of any industry watchdog. But the idea of News of the World getting to where it was in the first place still has to be addressed, and the growing fear surrounding whether indeed this could happen right here in Australia. Media commentator and former head of the National Crime Authority, Peter Farris QC, is calling for the abolition of the Australian Press Council to be replaced by an independent statutory body to examine media operations within Australia, as Nathan Coates discovered.
What has prompted you to call for the Australian Press Council to be abolished?
Well, it's a consequence of what is happening in the United Kingdom at the moment, where there is, as everybody knows, a major scandal about News of the World using dishonest and criminal and corrupt tactics to get information for their stories, such as hacking phones of innocent victims of crime, bribing police and so on.
And specifically, why do you think the Press Council should be abolished?
Well, the first thing that the UK Prime Minister Cameron did was to say that he was going to abolish the UK Press Council, which is much the same setup as the Australian one. It is self-regulatory and is paid for and financed by the print media. In other words, it is not independent at all. It's owned and operated by the print media on the basis that we're print journalists, you can trust us. Now, that's being abolished. There'll be a statutory body in the UK, and there's no doubt in my mind it's what we need to have here.
So on the News of the World scandal being, as you've said, prompting your call, Julian Disney, chair of the Press Council, says that hacking and other problems associated with News of the World are principally matters for the police, that they are not matters for industry regulators. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that simply proves my point that we need to get rid of Julian Disney and the Press Council, abolish both of them. The misconduct has got to be investigated, whether it's criminal misconduct or, as in a lot of what's happened in the UK, outrageous conduct, professional conduct by journalists, must be investigated. It must be investigated by an independent body. And the fact that the Australian Press Council would not, as they've indicated, look at such a thing here is a disgrace.
On the funding and getting to independence in terms of regulation, Julian Disney recognises that reliance on the media industry for funding is problematic in terms of the Australian Press Council. However, he did cite that the Communications and Media Authority is not doing much better. Disney said some of the worst forms of media malpractice may be indeed in radio and television more than in print.
Well, Julian Disney, from what you've told me, seems to have two explanations or defences. One is that it's a matter for the police, we're not going to investigate things. And two, that radio and television is worse than us. Neither of those meet the public interest. There needs to be an independent statutory authority for all media, whether it is print, radio or television, which has got power to investigate both corruption and, if necessary, in conjunction with the police force, criminal offences, but which has got power to investigate complaints of the public as to the conduct of the media.
So in terms of that power, and I guess you seem to be insinuating that the Press Council is a toothless tiger?
Absolutely.
Julian Disney says that that is really a matter of perception, and that we don't hear about the day-to-day complaints that they resolve.
Well, it is a matter of perception, and I think it's an accurate perception. It is, regardless of how good or bad they might think they are, you can't, in 2011, have journalists, having the print journalist community saying, trust us, we are journalists, we will fund a self-regulating body which will look after us. It's absurd.
Just getting back to the example of the Communications and Media Authority, it seems the question is more complex than simply that of funding. What are some of the other ways that you think, apart from gaining independence through funding, in terms of powers, what are some of the ways that media regulators can actually resolve matters before they do become criminal?
Well, I don't think they can necessarily resolve things before they become criminal, because if the act's been done, it's been done. It's either a crime or it's not. But there needs to be supervision of the media. And all that the UK drama demonstrates is that you can't trust the media. Certainly you can't trust the print media, and even more narrowly, you can't trust the Murdoch media. There needs to be an independent body set up by the government to supervise the media. Now, that's not very hard, and we can, once the government agrees to do that, well, then we can have a public debate as to how extensive the powers should be. But they must include a power to investigate.
Julian Disney says that the Press Council is engaged in standards projects to promote principles such as fairness and balance, and is seeking to obtain community views about problems with the media, including matters of systemic political bias. Should we not be looking at ways to strengthen the Press Council to indeed achieve some of the objectives that you've outlined, and to promote ethics in journalism rather than simply abolishing it?
We need to strengthen the community interest, and that can only be done by abolishing the Press Council, as I've said many times before in this conversation, which is financed by the press media and run by the press media and is voluntary regulation. There is no place left in Australia for voluntary regulation of the print media. It needs to be supervised by an independent government authority, the same as the electronic media is, and if that supervision up to date of electronic media hasn't been adequate, well then that needs to be given more teeth.
Peter Farris QC is a media commentator and the former head of the National Crime Authority, and he was speaking there to the Fourth Estate's Nathan Coates. How would you feel if the iconic role of Dale Kerrigan was played by Leonardo DiCaprio, or if Meryl Streep's acting chops were on show as Mrs. Rafter? This could well be the case if proposed changes to the Foreign Performer Certification Scheme guidelines are adopted. These changes could affect the way producers can hire international talent for Australian taxpayer-funded projects. The Save Spaces for Aussie Faces campaign hopes to ensure that this won't happen. Simon Whipp, Director of Actors Equity, the organisation representing the interests of Australian and New Zealand performers, told Jess Wingard all about the campaign.
The new reforms could mean that on a show like Packed to the Rafters, where at the moment the rules require that the cast be 100% Australian, up to 50% of the cast could be from overseas. And unfortunately, the likelihood is that it wouldn't be the Leonardo DiCaprios and the Meryl Streeps who are going to be working on a show like Pack to the Rafters in Australia, but we're talking about very much the D-grade and F-grade equivalents of Meryl Streep and Leonardo DiCaprio who we'd be bringing out to work on the shows in Australia.
Now, well, shouldn't the hiring of actors really be based on talent rather than place of birth?
Look, we're happy to for Australian performers to stand up alongside, in terms of quality, their international counterparts, and indeed I think they do. Jackie Weaver this year, of course, received an Oscar nominee along with her international counterparts. But in this part of the industry, we're talking about an area where the government has intervened, either in terms of providing for local content regulation or has provided direct finance or indirect finance for productions to occur. And those productions have been mandated by the government to occur not because they're wanting to employ cast and crew, but because they're wanting Australia to have the right to express itself as a nation culturally in the way it does when it funds writers to write, artists to paint, and so on, through the Australia Council, or directors to direct plays and employ actors on stage. There's a cultural mandate there that the Australia as a nation has a right to produce cultural product, and that cultural product should reflect the lives of the people in the country and should allow us to be proud about the nation who we are.
Yeah, well, how will these new changes place Australia's industry in comparison to the rest of the world?
Well, all of our overseas counterparts, in terms of the United Kingdom, Canada, the United States, New Zealand, all have similar restrictions on the use of overseas actors in their countries. Of course, the situation in each of their countries is different. Our rules reflect the nature and size of our industry, and the rules in the United States reflect the nature and size of their industry. For example, in the United States, the rules relate to whether a performer is of international distinction and merit. If a performer is of international distinction and merit, then the rules do allow that performer to work in their jurisdiction. So, for example, Jeffrey Rush has no difficulty working in the United States. The difference is the size of our industries. Their industry is only about generating money. It is the reason the industry exists, and it is the largest export earner for the United States. Our industry exists not because it's about generating money. Yes, in some cases, financially successful production does occur, but our industry exists only because the government has intervened to mandate for it to exist for cultural reasons, the creation of local content rules and the subsidy of film and television production.
Now, will online content be affected by these proposed changes?
Well, it will be. At the moment, the rules would indicate that only in the most exceptional circumstances would it be appropriate for a performer to come from overseas to work in Australian government-funded online content. Under the proposed rules, that would be opened up significantly.
Now, the safe...
Obviously, that is the way of the future.
The Safe Spaces for Aussie Faces campaign. Now, what are you ultimately hoping to achieve from this?
Look, what we're hoping to achieve is an outcome which is agreed between the industry, government and performers. That's what was achieved in the 1990s, an agreed outcome on what the immigration rules should be for performers between the industry, the government and performers, and we're hoping the same can be achieved here. We're not wanting a scenario where the rules are significantly opened up without any consultation with us. We're very happy that the government has now instituted a formal consultation process, and we're hopeful that will result in an agreement between all of the relevant parties.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to The Media Show that airs every week across the country on community radio. It's The Fourth Estate. Within the history of literary canon, the art of showing, not telling, is best exercised within the works of short fiction. And all the big-name authors started by perfecting this art form. And lately, too many stories have been focusing on the decline of the book publishing industry. So I needed to ensure a bit of optimism, and I came across the group Penguins Play Rough. Having recently launched its own self-publication with the work of the same name, the group came together by sharing a common love of creativity and writing, as well as performance. Pip Smith is the brains behind this enterprise and adamantly against the rigid notions of pigeonholing the arts into conformist categories, also acknowledging the iPhone generation with its own iPhone app available for download. Whichever way you look at it, they reckon that the publishing industry is secured for the near-distant future.
I'm Pip, and I organise a night called Penguin Plays Rough, which is a monthly night of short fiction.
My name is Luke Carman, and I'm one of the writers who was lucky enough to be in Pip's book. I was on stage, I was reading my work, I was reading a story. Pip was in the audience, you were in the audience, came up to me afterwards and said, you know, please come to this gig that I put on every month.
And we've just put together a book of short stories.
And Johnny called me up to ask if I was going along. What do they do, I asked, and he said, they tell stories. And I said, I don't know about stories, Johnny. Reed and Wacker called their tour the Wild Colonial Psychos Tour. The name of the tour made me laugh. It's not really funny at all. It's just that you hardly ever hear the word colonial anymore, so sometimes I think the fact that my ancestors were colonising convicts isn't important.
If I was a wanker, I would sit here saying, well, actually, it's called Penguin Plays Rough because we're being subversive and we're saying that this is publishing,
but, you know,
agitprop
and the postmodern
blah, 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 but it really isn't that complex. I wish I had put that much thought into it at the time. I never thought we would end up publishing a book in the first place.
Having the word penguin it works really well because it is, at the very first instance, kind of confusing. I've been a part of it for a while, to some degree, and I still don't know exactly where that comes from, even though I've heard the story a few times, you know, and it's kind of confusing, and it's good.
Hailing from an arts background, Pip Smith was discontent with the notion of rigid structures to make an artistic experience real.
I did an undergraduate degree in acting. There was so much, I don't know, dogma shoved down our throats about what you had to do. If you don't follow these rules about actions and objectives and rah, 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 then you're not a good actor and rah. So you end up on stage terrified that you might subconsciously do something wrong. I had a bit of a meltdown and I had to kind of go back and go, well, hang on, why did I even care about this in the first place? I really wanted to start Penguin Plays Rough so that it could be a relaxed atmosphere where you were allowed to be gross or weird or strange or, you know, whatever you wanted to be without being terrified that you might get picked on for bad grammar. I think that that needs to work in direct opposition with a kind of anxiety. Like, you do need to have a bit of a drive to make something good as well. But for me, making something good is it vital? Is it alive? Does it speak to other people? And I think what I love about it so much is that the generosity of sharing a story and the playfulness of it and being kind of hit over the head with someone else's imagination. I kind of think it's funny when people throw up their hands and go, oh, our industry's in peril. It's like, that seems to me a really kind of small-sighted way to deal with change, because technologies have changed forever, you know, like when the book first was printed, people were freaking out that what will this do to culture? Anyone will be able to read the Bible, and then what? If you look at the evolution of publishing technology at a great distance, you'll realize that things change, and they usually change because culture is changing, and then publishing needs to catch up with culture. And I don't think that means that we're going to stop reading books. Like, I don't think it, because I think we're human beings. We have a thirst to understand ideas and talk about ideas and read, talk to people or engage in some kind of discussion about why we're here, what we're doing, da da da. So that discussion's always going to be around, whether it's in a paperback or a hardback or an iPhone app or in a podcast. It doesn't matter, because it's all about, when you get back down to it, that the most important thing is that we're still, again, having good discussions that mean something.
I don't really understand how it works, because I know that people, they love novels. They when it comes down to it, they'll buy novels, but they're not supposed to be buying short stories. Like, people are not supposed to buy them. And for that reason, publishers aren't supposed to publish them. But I don't understand that at all, because surely everything, at least for my own sake, I can very rarely read a novel, and I like things that are very short. I can, short stories, I need a story to be extremely short, especially if I'm just going to listen to it, if I'm not going to actually read it. And I don't understand why they're not the only kind of literature that exists. I don't know why novels still exist in this culture.
They
seem like they should
have
gone away. Not that I would, I would miss them if they were gone, but I don't know why that it is the way it is. Is it just somebody...
attention spans, and people still want to read, and there is a place for the short story. It doesn't make sense to me that it almost seemed like that's what the industry, with a capital I again, had dictated they should publish. That novels were important, serious works because they took 3 years to write, or however long it takes to write, and that so therefore they were more important than a collection of short fiction. But I mean, if you look at the amount of short fiction collections that have come out and done really well, like Lydia Davis has collected short fiction, did really well, and that's really short fiction. Like
Helen Garner, I mean, Thomas Hardy, Truman Capote's, I mean, Breakfast at Tiffany's was actually a short story.
Because the reason why we did the app with the book is was an idea stolen from the music industry, because when I got the Fleet Foxes LP, it was this beautiful cover, and then it came with a download code, and I just thought, that is so clever. You've got the beautiful, cherishable object that you can hold on to and hug and kiss if you want, and then it's also very practical, because who can put an LP on their, you know, on their Discman? And it seems odd that, you know, the digital technologies have been working for years for the music industry and for publishing. It's like only now people are going, oh, wait.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane that it's a novelty what you've done.
I know. I'm often gobsmacked.
Barbara Streisand recognises one of the most accomplished female performers of her time. In fact, went into a 2006 tour. And it's believed that almost one-third of musicians now take beta blockers to combat this stress by effectively slowing their heart rate down. Professor Diana Kenny argues that this is not to be taken lightly, hence the release of her book that details her research in The Psychology of Musician Performance Anxiety. The accomplished classical musician and psychologist believes that we need to acknowledge this anxiety disorder as a true and real condition.
It's a very pervasive condition in the music industry, not just for classical musicians, but also for pop musicians. People tend to just accept the music that's offered by musicians without truly appreciating the enormous sacrifice in terms of dedication and practice and psychological demands that being a professional musician makes.
Yeah, I suppose it used to always just be referred to as a case of butterflies in the stomach. Can you determine the kind of standard nerves and that adrenaline that in many ways drives a performer to that of this kind of condition?
Yes, I think it's very important to recognise that a certain amount of arousal is very good, and we do run on nervous energy. But it's important to know that certain levels of arousal are facilitating of a performance, so it helps to get the drive and energy and excitement into a performance. But other levels can be debilitating, because it interferes with the musician's ability to produce, you know, the best performance that they can. One of the other major problems we have with the music industry currently is that children are being pushed into competitive situations from a very young age, and this is not healthy, because they come to expect that the only reason that they're valued is because of their performance ability, not because of who they are as people. And that means that there is so much invested in the performance that if anything goes wrong, it feels like a catastrophe.
And it even seems that the level of success that you can achieve is irrelevant, because some of the people that you name are the most successful musicians of our time. I mean, Barbara Streisand, Pavarotti, in theory, they wouldn't have anything to be nervous or doubt themselves over.
Well, objectively speaking, that may be true, but the fact that we know that there are a large number of extremely gifted and accomplished and successful musicians who experience this, it's a very complex issue. So just reaching the pinnacle of your profession is not a protection against the experience of extreme music performance anxiety.
The self-medication in themselves, alcohol and marijuana, well, they're known to be depressants. How, I guess, within the notion of therapy, can this be controlled?
You know, certain substances have their place, and a lot of musicians will say they're so hyped up, you know, after a big performance that they need a glass of wine, you know, to wind down. Nigel Kennedy was busted in Germany for having marijuana, and he told the police that he could not do his job, which is an international solo violinist, without it. If these substances are used very judiciously and hopefully under medical supervision, they do have a place in the management of severe music performance anxiety. But I would also like to see a lot of these musicians engage in a longer-term therapy to help them understand why it is that they believe that one bad performance is an absolute catastrophe.
Yeah, now, beta blockers, these have been talked about a lot of late. Can you just sort of, in a nutshell, describe, I guess, what they are and how they kind of affect you?
Well, beta blockers were originally developed to help people who'd had heart attacks. And what it does is slow the heart rate down, and it slows the whole autonomic nervous system down in order to give the heart a rest, so to speak, so that your heart is not working as hard while it's in a recovery stage. And then it was discovered that this same medication can reduce the somatic effects of anxiety, like butterflies in the stomach, shaking, trembling. These physical kinds of manifestations are also significantly reduced by the use of beta blockers, and that's why they're so popular amongst musicians.
Could this possibly be contagious to its audience? You know, the like, just referring to Cat Power, who kind of had to cancel her tour, or I guess I think of the infamous concert at the Annandale with the Vines. Craig Nicholls kind of had a massive, you know. And, you know, he got quite aggressive on stage. Is there that possibility that this anxiety could in fact, you know, be transferred onto its audience who are paying to see these guys as that, you know, maybe they have put them on a pedestal a bit as a role model, a hero or an idol in that sense, and that's what the pressure...
Fans have their concerts cancelled. I don't think it's going to make them anxious. I think it's going to make them angry.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not contagious, you know, in the sense of being transmitted from performer to audience, but musicians themselves believe that music performance anxiety is contagious from one musician to another. So if one musician is acting anxiously, they believe that it will affect their fellow musicians. And that's why there's been a bit of a cone of silence around the whole question. It's just not acceptable to talk about it, because I think it's accepted that the majority of people do experience music performance anxiety to some extent, and it's your responsibility to deal with it, and therefore, you know, you don't put it on to your musical colleagues.
Professor of Psychology and Music at the University of Sydney, Diana Kenny, has just released a book out now at Oxford University Press about music performance anxiety. Check it out. That's it for another week on The Fourth Estate. Do check us out online. We're on 4thestateradio.blogspot.com. I'm Mick Caldwell. Take care.